This is the first day of this July-August 2018 seven-day session. Before we begin with our text for today, I'll say a few words about how to listen to a Teisho. I haven't done this in a long time. It's especially important that beginners understand this. So it depends on what practice you're working on. If your practice is a koan, like say the koan mu, then you want to try to continue your awareness of the koan as you're listening. You can do this. In the beginning, it may seem at odds. The two may seem at odds with each other. How can you listen and have your awareness on the koan? But as the koan seeps into the mind, over time you learn that you can have the awareness of the koan in the sort of the back of the mind as you're listening, and it can actually help keep thoughts from interfering in the pure listening to the Teisho. If your practice is breath practice or shikantaza, then there's just listening, which implies also noticing when thoughts are interfering. What kind of thoughts? Well, thoughts about thoughts that are associated with what you're hearing. You can go off on tangents of thoughts and then miss the pure message of what teacher is saying, or thoughts of what you agree with or disagree with, memories that may be triggered by things you're hearing. These things can happen, but to not pursue them, not to dwell in these thoughts, but to try to notice and then simply drop the thoughts and just listen. The text we'll be starting with this session is called Zen Letters, and they're the teachings of Chinese Zen master Yuan Wu. And these were translated by the Cleary brothers, J.C. Cleary and Thomas Cleary. Yuan Wu is most famous as the author of the Blue Cliff Record, an outstanding collection of koans. Even among lay people, non-Zen practitioners, in China, this is a famous text because of its great literary quality. He lived in the 11th and 12th centuries of China, and these are drawn from letters that he wrote to various fellow teachers, disciples, lay students, women and men alike, householders, monks, nuns, advanced students, beginners. We're going to pick up on page 29. These next 30 or so pages we haven't read from in a long time. And the translators give this section the title, Hidden Treasure. Brave-spirited wearers of the patched robe possess an outstanding, extraordinary aspect. With great determination, they give up conventional society. They look upon worldly status and evanescent fame as dust in the wind as clouds floating by, as echoes in a valley. There's no doubt that those who become monks and nuns, especially in the traditional sense of celibate monks and nuns who leave their families, their parents, that this is a remarkable commitment. All right, it's not a commitment that everyone upholds through their entire life, but consider what an act this is to turn one's back on fame and glory and wealth and worldly success just in order to devote one's life to the Dharma. Well, that wasn't always the reason that people became ordained in ancient times. There were other reasons. Poverty was a reason that parents would bring their young children to the monastery, knowing that there they had a good chance of getting their being fed and housed. There were also those who became monks in order to avoid the draft. This is in ancient China, at least. But for those whose aspiration was genuine, and they just wanted to devote this lifetime to full-time practice of the way, the Tao, it's a remarkable thing. Practice doesn't mean just sitting, of course. Sitting is the smallest part of practice. Practice means in whatever one is doing, to do so without attachment to thoughts, random, irrelevant thoughts that come into the mind. He continues, since they already have great faculties and great capacity from the past, they know that this level exists and they transcend birth and death and move beyond holy and ordinary. Just to pause here, since they already have great faculties and great capacity from the past, no doubt what he means is from past lives. This would be rebirth, would be assumed in ancient China, and that everything is cause and effect. So to wish to make the vows of take monastic vows would be the effect of previous lives, where one is, even if one were not a monk in the past, one would have experienced something that would turn one's mind toward that which is beyond worldly phenomena. Again, wealth, success, so forth. Sometimes this would be great suffering. Loss of people close to you, and in losing something very fundamental to your life, realizing that really there's no way not to lose if one is living this life. Any life. Sickness, injury, the suffering of old age, and then, of course, death itself. To people whose minds are ready, they don't need any more evidence of the need to see what is beyond change, beyond loss. Or maybe just having made great efforts in the Dharma in the past, even if they weren't monks, would turn one's mind toward the ephemeral nature, or it would be tend to confirm the characteristics of existence of no self, suffering, impermanence. They know, since they already have great faculties and great capacity from the past, they know that this level exists. Some deep awareness. I don't know if you could even call it memory of these things. And they transcend birth and death and move beyond holy and ordinary. This is the indestructible true essence that all the enlightened ones of all times witness, the wondrous mind that alone the generations of enlightened teachers have communicated. To tread this unique path, that is the monastic path, to be a fragrant elephant or a giant golden-winged bird. These are allusions to mythical states of supreme attainment. It is necessary to charge past the millions of categories and types and fly above them, to cut off the flow and brush against the heavens. We see here already the magnificent use of words that Yuan Wu attained. In Zen, we can speak of dead words and live words. Dead words are conceptual words, abstract words. Live words are the opposite. And Yuan Wu has so much rich, uses language in such a rich and vivid way. He's sort of the king of live words. So just this one sentence, it is necessary to charge past the millions of categories and types and fly above them, to cut off the flow and brush against the heavens. How could the enlightened willingly be petty creatures, confined within distinctions of high and low, and victory and defeat, trying futilely to make comparative judgments of instantaneous experience, and being utterly turned around by gain and loss? In other words, how can the enlightened be bound by dualistic words, dualistic concepts of gain and loss, attainment or no attainment, enlightenment or no enlightenment, judgments, evaluations, categories, classifications, ideas of right and wrong, good and bad? All of this is, these are concepts. For this reason, in olden times, the people of great enlightenment did not pay attention to trivial matters and did not aspire to the shallow and easily accessible. They aroused their determination to transcend the Buddhas and patriarchs. They wanted to bear the heavy responsibility that no one can fully take up, to rescue all living beings, to remove suffering and bring peace, to smash the ignorance and blindness that obstructs the way. They wanted to break the poisonous arrows of ignorant folly and extract the thorns of arbitrary views from the eye of reality. They wanted to make the scenery of the fundamental ground clear and reveal the original face before the empty aeon. This heavy responsibility that no one can bear, that is the vow to rescue all living beings, liberate all living beings, we take this vow, at least in Sesshin, all of us, every day, two or three times every day, and it is important to recognize the significance of taking these vows, starting with the first one, all beings without number I vow to liberate. This places our effort, our exertions, beyond self-interest, beyond even our wanting to come to awakening for our own relief. Because what we're doing with these vows is we're vowing to, yes, to come to enlightenment for the sake of others, for the sake of all beings, which means to be able to better help others, to serve, to respond to others. This is what awakening, even to a small degree, brings, is this readiness, the responsiveness, the awareness of others' pain and suffering that has to come first, is the awareness, and then the responding. This is far beyond with this sort of generic, commonplace mindfulness that has found its way into every aspect of our secular society. Mindfulness in order to boost your earning power and become more successful, even more concentrated. This is beyond that. It's beyond self. It's beyond self. And because we are so attached to self, we need to take this vow over and over again, dozens of times, hundreds of times, thousands of times, to remind ourselves of the great promise of this practice, this way to help others, to relieve others' suffering, as well as our own. Ours goes along with it. We don't have to worry about relieving our own suffering. That comes with it if we are dedicated to helping others, to remove suffering and bring peace, to smash the ignorance and blindness that obstructs the way. They wanted to extract the thorns of arbitrary views from the eye of reality. Our true eye, our true wisdom, it becomes obscured by arbitrary views, opinions, notions, belief systems. They wanted to make the scenery of the fundamental ground clear and reveal the original face. The original face is our true nature, our essential nature, our self nature, capital S self, at the beginning of this paragraph, he said that people of great enlightenment did not pay attention to trivial matters. What would he mean by that, trivial matters? Well, probably he meant one's own physical pain. No doubt Yuan Wu would consider that trivial. And his predecessors as well, because there's almost no reference I've ever encountered in Zen texts. There's no reference to physical pain. I think these masters would it would be assumed that, of course, when you're sitting hours and hours a day, that you would have to contend with some discomfort at least. It wasn't even brought up. Did not pay attention to trivial matters. Of course, you can be sure he meant all of the busy matters that people that occupy people's minds, people generally in society, all the matters of sports and celebrities and the infinitude of stuff that one can just gorge on in the internet, social media, really just about anything is trivial compared to the great matter of life and death. Insights, psychological insights, philosophical insights, Yuan Wu would consider trivial. Doesn't mean there's anything wrong with them. This is one of the things we can, the benefits of Sesshin and Zen practice generally is insights about ourselves, the ways that we trip ourselves up, the habit forces, the toxic patterns that we cling to in our relationships, it's wonderful to have these insights that liberate us to a small degree. Same with philosophical insights. It can be very gratifying, but how can they compare to seeing into this, the great matter? So there's some saying from, maybe it's India, I don't know. It goes like this. Whoso desires the ocean makes light of streams. And this will determine distinguishing between the trivial and the fundamental. This will determine to a large extent how long one perseveres in Zen practice. If the rewards of practice, the rewards in terms of physical well-being and emotional well-being, the psychological insights, the philosophical insights, if these aren't satisfying enough, as wonderful as they may be, if they're not satisfying enough, one is likely to continue through them, beyond them. some people who come to practice from a state of emotional disquiet and find that through some months or even years of practice, these issues are resolved, emotional issues. They can then, it's enough. It's just the way it is for them. That's enough. Okay, I got some relief. I feel better about myself. My relationships are working out better. And then that's enough for them. Or maybe they'll continue practicing, but it'll be in this sort of uneventful, safe and uneventful way of practicing, where you just kind of maintain a daily dosage. It's like having a glass of wine or at the end of the day, not really going further in practice. Well, anyone who comes to Sesshin is not in that category, because you can't just maintain in Sesshin. Here we are confronted by one obstacle after another, one challenge after another. And that's the great value of Sesshin, is not being able to sort of dust off one's hands and say, okay, good enough. At least we cannot, during this week, we can't. He continues, you should train your mind and value actual practice wholeheartedly, exerting all your power, not shrinking from the cold or the heat. Go to the spot where you meditate and kill your mental monkey and slay your intellectual horse. Make yourself like a dead tree, like a withered stump. Yeah, there are a couple more trivialities from his perspective. The cold or the heat, people can get hung up on these things. The conditions of practice, expecting to find comfortable conditions. And if you don't have the most comfortable conditions, then you excuse yourself from practicing or going to Sesshin. We're in a society that does not value adversity, largely speaking. Somehow there is the expectation that we should be able to find comfort and ease. This is owed to us, and to encounter pain, physical pain or mental pain, is seen as kind of an affront. Why should we have to put up with that? Well, one reason is because it's training in facing our pain, facing adversity. We are developing ourselves so that in the future, when the pain gets worse and the adversity gets worse through old age and yes, death ultimately, we can manage it better. We can move along with the suffering. But it's not just future. It's not just in order to be better equipped in the future to deal with pain. But it's that to avoid pain is to avoid life. Because life is pain. To try to avoid pain is to condemn oneself to a shallow experience of life. Not that we want to go out and try to find more pain. That's sort of the other extreme. That sort of can be masochistic. But pain has tremendous value in terms of building character and showing us what is beyond our sense experiences, what is beyond pleasure and pain. As long as we're caught in this on the horns of pleasure and pain, we will be not at all living to our fullest. Kill your mental monkey. It's often called the monkey mind, this discriminating intellect of ours that can't just leave things as they are, but has to dwell in thoughts about things. And slay your intellectual horse. Here in another, skipping a few pages here, he says, my teacher, Wuzu, often said, I have been here for 5 decades and I have seen thousands and thousands of Zen followers come up to the corner of my meditation seat. They were all just seeking to become Buddhas and to expound Buddhism. I have never seen a single genuine wearer of the patched robe. A true monk in the fundamental sense of someone who is beyond seeking, beyond expounding. When he says they were all just seeking to become Buddhas, this means they're attached to attainment, to getting something for oneself. He continues, how true this is. As we observe the present time, even those who expound Buddhism are hard to find, much less any genuine people. The age is in decline and the sages are further and further distant. Remember, this is the 12th century, he's saying this. In the whole great land of China, the lineage of Buddha is dying out right before our very eyes. We may find one person or half a person who is putting the Dharma into practice, but we would not dare to expect them to be like the great exemplars of enlightenment, the dragons and elephants of yore. Back to this phrase, they were all just seeking to become Buddhas and to expound Buddhism. No doubt he means to expound Buddhism means they want to become teachers. Nothing worries me more than a student who is determined to become a teacher. It's natural to want to share with others this practice that has benefited one so much, but to set one's sights on becoming a teacher shows that there is still ambition that is holding one back. He continues, if you simply know the procedures and aims of practical application of the Dharma and carry on correctly from beginning to end, you are already producing a lotus from within the fire. Here he's saying, just do the practice. Do it. Don't be thinking about the future. Don't be even thinking about practice. Just do it. And through the doing of the practice alone, there comes these benefits, this deepening of wisdom and compassion. So the marvelous thing about this practice, Zen practice, truly marvelous, is that there's nothing more we need to do than just the practice. We don't need to figure anything out. We don't need to really even have a much of a grasp of the doctrine of Buddhism. It's just by doing this practice day in and day out, devotedly, persistently, not sporadically, not when it suits, just when it suits us and skipping it at other times, but seeing it through. That itself is enough. We'll bring change, the most wonderful change eventually, insight. Just doing the practice day in and day out lightens us, relieves us of this baggage that we carry around. He continues, you must put aside all the conditioning that entangles you. Okay, even there, we don't have to think about putting anything aside. It is through the practice that the conditioning falls away. Then you will be able to perceive the inner content of the great enlightenment that has come down since ancient times. Be at rest wherever you are and carry on the secret, closely continuous, intimate level practice. Be at rest wherever you are means to allow the mind to settle. Just be present, fully present, without dwelling in thoughts. Be at rest, carry on the secret, closely continuous, intimate level practice. It's another way to understand Zen practice broadly. It's developing intimacy with everything and everyone. And that too happens on its own, without us trying to develop intimacy. The devas will have no road to strew flowers on, and demons and outsiders will not be able to find your tracks. This is 12th century language he's using here, meaning that we become empty. We become free of any taint of self. And as a result, we're free of these things. Demons and outsiders. Demons, just the old language for obstructive patterns, fears, emotional afflictions. This is what it means to truly leave home and thoroughly understand oneself. Leave home. The literal term for monks were home leavers. So he says this is really the essence of the monastic life. Well, this brings us to the end of a chapter, so let's stop now and recite the four vows. All beings without number, I vow to pray.
endless line, Bashan's eye bowed above root, to Armageddon beyond measure, I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha, I bow to attain all beings without number, I bow to liberate endless blind passions, I bow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure, I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha, I bow to attain all beings without number, I bow to liberate endless blind passions, I bow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure, I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha, I bow to attain.